Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. We're continuing our coverage of the Air Force Association's 2020 Airspace Cyber Conference and Trade Show, this year conducted virtually. We're joined by a roundtable of some of the nation's leading air and space thinkers and reporters: John Turpak, the veteran reporter for Air Force Magazine; Steve Trimble of Aviation Week and Space Technology; Todd Harrison of the Center for Strategic and International Studies; and retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant General Dave Deptula, the Dean of the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies, that is part of AFA. Welcome all. Thanks very, very much for joining us, especially after three blockbuster AFA days.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having us.
Glad to be here.
And glad to be back.
Look forward to chatting, Vago.
And Dave, in your case, thanks very much. You're joining us twice, so I appreciate it. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our strategy coverage. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. John, I'd like to start with you. I think this was your 35th AFA. Is that right?
I've lost track.
You've lost track, but you've done it long enough to be able to lead us off. The only other person I think who's done more of them probably is Dave Deptula. But let's go around the horn. I want to get each of your takes, given that you're bringing different experience levels and different experiential levels, I should say, to this. Start off from your standpoint, John. You know, what were some of the key takeaway messages? As you know, General Deptula joined us earlier in the week to talk about the Chief's Accelerate Change or Lose. We heard from Byron Callen of Capital Alpha Partners, who talked to us a little bit about after Dr. Roper's Next Generation Air Dominance announcement on Tuesday. Talk to us about what are some of the interesting messages that you picked up as somebody who, unless I'm mistaken, was on almost every single one of the press conferences that the general officers gave.
Sure. Well, I did listen into a lot of them. I was struck by two things: one, what we did hear, and what we didn't hear. What we didn't hear: General Brown came out of the gate pretty fast with his paper, Accelerate Change or Lose, in which he said we're going to have to do some ruthless prioritization, clearly setting the stage for we're going to have to get rid of some legacy systems in order to pay for the future. Last year at this very same conference, the then Chief of Staff General Goldfein actually named some names, including the B-1 bomber as one that would have to be reduced for that purpose. This year, we didn't get that. They stayed very, very clear of naming any names and deferred to a Corona meeting, which I think is happening in early October, where presumably they're gonna figure out what's gonna have to go in terms of the legacy system. So that was surprising to me that they hadn't lined that up already. And of course, I was surprised what we did hear about the NGAD, the future air dominance airplane. We'd been told, you know, that could be 5 years away. And then Will Roper says, not only is it not 5 years away, we have designed it, built it, flown it, and it's got a lot of it's set a lot of records. So that was really interesting. So those were the two things that really struck me as the big takeaways from the conference.
And I should also point out what I thought was also interesting was nobody in the course of this, right? I mean, when General Kelly, the new Air Combat Command Chief, this successor to Mobile Holmes, who was being pressed on F-15 EX, and I think it was you, Steve, who may have pushed him on it a little bit, you know, sort of made the argument, well, you know, it's a great capability, it's a great airplane, it's going to give us a lot of capability, as opposed to saying, or maybe it was Tony Capaccio, I can't remember, but Tony may have asked, like, okay, well, wait a minute, how are you going to square all of these programs when you have more programs than you've got money? Steve, walk us through some of the things you thought were most interesting. And on NGAD, the question is, was it one of the demonstrators? Did they down-select an airplane? Was it the down-selected airplane? Was it one of the many competitors for it? Right? There was no indication on that. But from your reporting, what did you think was sort of interesting about that? And what are sort of outstanding questions we all have?
Sure. Well, so what was announced by Dr. Roper, very tersely, but very excitingly. I mean, I'm all for hearing about new secret aircraft having flown. I love seeing them even more, but hearing about them is thrilling as well. But what he announced was that it was a full-scale flying flight demonstrator. And, you know, all those terms mean something. It can be very vague. And so we don't know exactly what it is that actually flew. We don't know when it flew. We don't know how many times it's flown. The records that it's broken, we don't really know what those are, if those relate to the flight performance of the aircraft. Although in this case, I think it's more likely it relates to the speed of development, the cost of development, the ease of upgrading and modifying and that kind of thing. Because that seems to be the whole thrust of how they introduced it at this show. Because I think that's also interesting. They didn't really introduce it as, here's the, you know, so General Goldfein last year said there are five major technologies that they're developing for next generation air dominance, and that they needed a test article to validate those in flight,
right,
for maturity. And so, you know, we don't know if they're talking about putting all of those five technologies onto the same aircraft, or if there will be different version, you know, a subset of those five technologies on you know, that go on the aircraft one at a time.
Well, I should point out, just dive in if I can for one moment. Dr. Roper did say that all of those subordinate systems had all been tested on different platforms, presumably before they got integrated onto this platform and flew. That's the message I took away from what he said. I don't know if I'm mistaken in that, but he did seem to say each one of these little subsystems were already tested on other platforms before they went into this one, which I also thought was kind of an interesting message.
Yeah. Well, and you would normally expect that too, you know, especially with any mission systems. But like I said, I mean, a flight demonstrator could be a lot of different things. You know, for the F-22, it was the F-16 AFTI. They also used an F-16 as a demonstrator for the F-35 in the JAS program. So it could be an existing aircraft and a variant of that, or it could be a completely new thing. So it's hard to know at this point, based on what they've told us, what we're actually talking about. And how that relates to the overall message, I think, is the most interesting thing, because what they're saying is that this is a proof of concept, that this validates this very new and very radical disruptive approach that Dr. Roper and the Air Force leadership want to take with the Next Generation Air Dominance program. Because it's not just about sort of shaking up how you do the air dominance mission. It's also completely changing the way the industry and the Air Force goes about buying, designing, developing, manufacturing, and then modernizing and sustaining these kinds of aircraft. There's some examples they point to, the F-117 being the sort of the prime example, because that was a small batch aircraft. It was, they built about 59 of them. They retired them after a relatively short period of time compared to other legacy aircraft. And then they moved on to new technologies. And that's kind of what they want to do with this. Dr. Roper said he wants to retire whatever comes out of Next Generation Air Dominance, which will be a family of systems. He wants those, you know, the individual members to be retired within 15 years of when they entered service, because by that point, they'll necessarily be obsolete and it'll be time to move on to the next technology rather than sustaining it.
Right. And in keeping with this sort of century series model of cycle through, be not as ambitious, but sort of build capability with each, successive subtype. Let me ask one other question. You know, you were constantly asking about a multiplicity of sort of smaller systems, right? And so has the Air Force done as good of a job sort of explaining all the other, like LCAT and, you know, I mean, these, all of these sort of, right? Yeah. So they've got Grey Wolf as the helicopter, but then there might be another platform called Grey Wolf as well, right? I mean, so the Air Force has got to do a better job on these acronyms a little bit. But, you know, what did you glean from the multiplicity of different sort of weapons and demonstration programs that are also ongoing?
I mean, it's an acronym soup of letters with the autonomous vehicles. There's the LCAT program, low cost attritable aircraft technology. There's the LCAPS, And so what, so what happened was they awarded a contract to Kratos under the LCAP program, but they also kept several other companies funded doing different aircraft. Those are all still secret. That was Northrop Grumman, Lockheed, Boeing, and General Atomics. They started at the same time Kratos was working on XQ-58. They were also working on new platforms under a related program. Those have all come together now with Skyborg. The Skyborg contract awards went to Kratos, which was the LCAT contractor, as well as three of the companies involved in LCAPs, Northrop, General Atomics, and Boeing. So now you've got four, those four different platforms going forward with Skyborg, which, by the way, I mean, the whole purpose of Skyborg is that the Skyborg design agent, which is Leidos under a separate contract, is developing the control system. This autonomous control system that it learns through artificial intelligence algorithms and isn't programmed in the way a normal flight control system is. So that's potentially revolutionary. And if it's possible, it dovetails back into the Next Generation Air Dominance program at some point, but it's not clear how.
Todd, let's go to space. Obviously, this was the first AFA where we had Space Force. General Raymond is the chief of space operations. There was a little bit of questions about what the anthem or the song for the Space Force is going to be. But more interestingly, it was fascinating to me how many senior leaders, even C.Q. Brown, chief of the Air Force, 22nd chief of staff of the Air Force, was talking about, hey, are there any lessons on headquarters consolidation and streamlining we can derive from what General Raymond and his team have done, right? General Raymond said originally we were supposed to have 1,000 people in headquarters, and it ended up taking several layers to reduce that number to a couple of hundred. Talk to us a little bit about what some of the key space messages you picked up over the course of 3 days, numerous briefings, events, what have you.
I mean, the main message coming out of the Space Force this week has been, giving a status update, if you will, talking about how they've got a lean headquarters staff and being very cognizant of the fact that everything they do right now is setting precedents for the future of this service. So they're trying to be very careful and set a positive, productive precedence. But they're also mindful that the Space Force, because of its size, because of its newness, they can, be an experimental platform for how they manage different, administrative functions and how they manage their personnel that can serve as an example to the other services. So, I've heard a lot of talk about how they're trying to be mindful of the fact that they need to manage their workforce differently. And they're going to try and experiment and hopefully serve, as that example to prove out concepts that the other services may want to follow in the future. But, beyond that and beyond the swearing in ceremony, which is, a risk they took on their part to try to do a virtual swearing in across multiple locations at the same time. I think that there was a lot of emphasis on the new space power doctrine, this document, the capstone document that they published back in June, talking about the importance of that and how that lays the groundwork. And now it's a living document and they are going to be updating it over time and then filling out lower levels of detail in the doctrine. But I would say that one thing that caught my eye that probably didn't get as much attention as it deserved is the role of the Space Force in ABMS. And in this demo that they pulled off just a couple of weeks ago, looking at all the different parts of that actually relate to space, that actually fall under the responsibility of the Space Force. And it does start to make you, scratch your head and wonder, where does this mission really belong? It seems like the Space Force is going to have a very prominent role in whatever ABMS ends up being in the future.
And I should point out, Todd, what you're talking about, Dave, you and I talked about it a little bit on Monday, was the September 3rd, 2020 test, where Army howitzers were used to engage and shoot down cruise missiles. And that was a demonstration of the advanced battle management system, as well as testing out some technology, obviously for also JADC2, there was some artificial intelligence in it. And Dr. Roper pointed out, you know, when I was the head of the Strategic Capabilities Office, for 7 years, I was telling people, hey, you know, what we've got, we can do something novel for air-based defense to try to turn, what did he say? Instead of Iron Dome, it's a tungsten dome, and get on the right side of the cost curve where you're using, 155 millimeter artillery rounds as opposed to multi-million dollar missiles to do the shooting down. So that was certainly a very, very impressive demonstration. And Steve, going back to your point, right, Dr. Roper said he revealed the NGAD information to show all the naysayers that actually a very, very sophisticated program like this can move very, very quickly, go from a digital e-design all the way to bending metal and successfully flying it. Dave, it's been the end of the 3 days. You hosted a lot of the on-demand panels, some great conversations. We talked a little bit about stand-in and stand-out strike. But talk to us a little bit about what some of the messages at the end of the 3 days that you thought were most noteworthy.
Bago, as you were talking, I find it of interest that the Department of Defense has finally found something of use for the Army's inventory of howitzers for the future.
Ouch.
Well, I mean, it's an excellent demonstration of adapting older technology to new applications. And hopefully the Army will be excited about this fact to the degree that they'll go back and actually put some time and effort into one of their foundational missions, which is air-based defense. On another note, it was exciting with Dr. Roper's announcement with respect to NGAD, but as Steve mentioned, it's kind of hard to know what Dr. Roper really means, given the lack of details. I don't think it's a surprise to anybody that the military has secret prototypes that are flown on a semi-regular basis. But really, it's important to know if this was just an airplane or a test bed, because the challenging issue is the actual systems integration that will create the real operational value of any kind of airborne system. So the multi-billion dollar question is just what were they testing? New physical production techniques linked with the digital engineering aids or actual operational technology? So let me put those two apart because they're kind of things-based and talk a bit about what you asked, and that's the underlying messages. I think collectively listening to some of the senior most leader positions, the takeaway is there's a realization that the threat is real in terms of the peer threat. It's urgent, and we've got to move out, and we got to move out fast, as underlined by the chief, to meet our nation's security challenges. Second, it means changing fast. And what was really refreshing to hear a senior leader talk about is taking risk to do so. And along with that, he talked about delegating authority, not just talking about it, which kind of reconfirms number three, that leadership matters. And his point was sort of a green light to those innovative leaders out there to grab the opportunity and apply it, particularly when it comes to operational constructs and to moving our doctrine forward. To move past the mother may I ask before acting model that's characterized the Air Force for the past decade or two. I was particularly struck by the Chief of Space Operations presentation. It was tight. It was on target. And it was insightful, what General Raymond had to say. I mean, he specifically addressed the fact that, hey, we've got over 65 organizations out there with over 30 that have a role in Space Force design. And this is a quote, we are now going to go after that bureaucracy. That was refreshing. And here was another one. Quote, the relationship with the intelligence community needs to evolve as well as with the other services. So that tells me he's not just resting on that initial legislation, but he's actually interested in taking on some of the more difficult organizational issues that are fundamentally why we've stood up a separate space organization. But the bottom line is, I thought it was an excellent conference given the virtual nature and the challenge with that. And I'm really very optimistic about the message and the tone of the Air Force's senior leadership.
I want to go back one moment and, Todd, bring you in because you are a congressional and budget expert here as well. What are the pressures that are on the NGAD program? Because it would seem as though the Air Force is trying to do an enormous amount of lot with a fixed amount of money, and now you have the F-15 EX program that's eating into that, right? The Air Force is trying to execute F-35. But not getting up to the production rates. I mean, obviously, there's a little bit of a challenge because of COVID-related impacts on production of what is a global program. At the same time, you have the Air Force that's trying to deliver on the B-21 program. The KC-46 is late, and those are being modernized at only 14 airplanes a year. Now you're going to have to make money available because you have the F-15 EX under contract. Going back to what John said, nobody's trading anything off. There was no discussion of airplanes that are going to be retired this time around. So it's interesting that this is an opportunity lost, right, to at least have paved the way for things potentially to go away. Talk to us about what the pressures are financially on the Air Force at this time and how the service is actually going to be able to put 10 pounds in a 5-pound bag.
10 pounds of what, Vago?
I'll let you fill in the blank.
10 pounds of fighter jet.
Exactly.
Well, first of all, let's look back, you know, at the budget history here on the NGAD program. So the Air Force has been getting funding for that program, that funding line, I should say, since 2015. And they've gotten so far a total of $1.7 billion since 2015 for this program. And now they've got, you know, a flying prototype of some kind. We don't know if it's like a fighter jet or if it's part of this family of systems. It might be a cousin, who knows. But going forward, I think you're right that here's the challenge for the Air Force. They're projecting right now over the next 5 years, they're going to need $7.6 billion for this program. As they ramp up development, not even getting into procurement yet. Procurement's not yet projected for the program. So $7.6 billion in additional development. And on the Hill, they're going to have to make the argument for this program while they are starting to buy new fourth-gen fighters, F-15EX. They're continuing to buy fifth-gen fighters, F-35A. And now they're going to buy what I guess is a sixth-gen fighter. You know, that's going to be a tough sell. And looking at the budget outlook right now, DoD is projecting a flat budget that just basically grows with inflation over the next 5 years. That was pre-COVID. Depending on what happens in this election, if you know the White House changes, if the Senate changes, if the economic recovery is slower than expected, if folks get spooked about the deficit sooner than expected, you know, we could be looking at a real deficit-driven downturn in defense. And where does that put the Air Force? And where does that put this program? I think that, you know, there's going to have to be a lot of work to keep this program on track. And ultimately, if it is a priority for the Air Force, you've got to look at what are the trade-offs? What are you willing to give up to keep this program in the future? And I know that's a tough situation to be in. There's no easy answer, but I think that's the reality of where they are.
John, did you hear, you know, you're the one who brought the issue up about what we didn't hear. Did you find enough discussion on the fiscal future and anything that you could glean from anything any of the combat commanders said as well that would lead us to believe what would be protected and what wouldn't B?
Yeah, there seemed to be a resolute disinterest in talking about anything that could be budget related. I don't think they know. I think they were being honest in saying that they're going to have this this meeting in early October to hash things out and decide what stays and what goes. But clearly there's more going into the program than they're going to be able to afford. General Clint Hynote spoke recently, and he was he used to be the AFWIC. He's he was talking about programs that just are not legacy programs are simply going to have to go away, and one has to ask whether something like F-15EX counts as a legacy program. When General Goldfein was the chief of staff, he was resolute that the F-15 would never intrude on the F-35's funding stream. So far, probably that's true, but as Todd says, in a year or so, everything's going to be in what General Mark Kelly was talking as a cage match between the F-35 and the F-15EX.
Steve, let me bring you in on this. You know what it costs to develop high-end combat aircraft. You could argue that $1.7 billion is actually not a lot of money to actually end up with something that's been flying. Although, you know, as Dave said, it shouldn't come to a surprise to any of us that there are highly classified airplane programs. Obviously they're ongoing continuously. But do you think that this is a potential paradigm shift in any way?
Oh,
in terms of being able to deliver capability, if we can get it done, you know, even if it's at a $7 billion mark?
Right. Well, and I would actually add to that $7 billion that, I mean, it was supposed to be a lot more. I mean, if you go back to the fiscal year 2018 budget plan and the 2019 budget plan, there was a huge shift. They originally had $13.2 billion in the timeframe between fiscal year 20 and fiscal year 2024. And in the fiscal year 20 budget request that came out last year, they took out half of that. So, I mean, you know, $7.6 billion sounds like a lot, but it was actually supposed to be a lot more. But I think that was when they shifted the concept from a penetrating counter air as sort of the centerpiece of this program to more of a federated system of systems type architecture. What they're talking about doing is really, really big and transformational. I mean, breaking up the industry approach to this instead of a winner-take-all contract where you're sort of locked into the same company for the design, the production, sustainment, modernization, breaking all that up into, you know, different companies can be involved in all those different stages of the program. Just as important as it is to our warfare, this program is to the defense industry and how it could change things. But when you're going to break something in the process, and sometimes you can, you know, that works out really well and it needs to be broken. And sometimes, you know, something even worse comes out of that. And it's hard to know which way this one is going to go. It does seem like, you know, this is going back to sort of a lead system integrator approach, like Future Combat Systems, but without Boeing or, you know, a traditional defense company being the prime, but having the Air Force as the prime. We just don't know how that's going to work out. And, it's a really interesting idea, but it's all unproven at this point. And when they cite this flight demonstrator, the NGAD flight demonstrator is sort of the proof and the graduation of this idea. That's interesting. I just want to know a lot more about what this flight demonstrator really is and how it actually validated all those ideas.
Hey, well, Steve and Bago, let me jump in here.
Yeah, of course.
A couple of observations. I think what several of the folks have already mentioned, the fact that, look, we got a real challenging budget ahead. And at the same time, the Air Force really needs to be complimented. Dr. Roper, the previous chief, the current chief, on pushing new ways of doing business. So at the macro level, sure, everybody's interested in knowing what the specific details are, but we tend to gloss over the fact that, you know, this is a change in a way of doing business, and the Air Force leadership needs to be applauded for getting that change through sort of the don't bring us new ideas mid-level bureaucracy that tends to hold services at bay. So really well done in terms of changing the nature of how they do business and really making innovative and new and different ways of doing business a reality. Now, all that said, as Todd mentioned, the Air Force has got to make some changes, which takes us back to General Brown's focus on changing and needing to change fast and making difficult decisions. I would tell you that the litmus test of this is going to be just what happens with F-15EX. If it's not killed, then one is there are going to be people out there that question, are these statements about hard choices and needing to face and invest in what is going to make a difference in the future, are they really meaningful or not? Then again, if the choices are toward advanced technology and systems that can be used in a China scenario or a Russia scenario, then those words will matter. I think that's the big test that folks are waiting to see what the outcome and what the specifics, how those words turn into reality and what happens.
I want to, you know, echo what Dave said that, you know, the Air Force and Will Roper, they do deserve a lot of credit for trying something different, for pushing it through, for breaking the status quo when it comes to the acquisition process and acquisition strategy. You know, I'm not entirely convinced that this is the right type of program to apply this approach to, but good for them for trying. I would like to see them apply this Digital Century Series approach to space systems because they inherently, you're going to need to replace them every 10, 15, 20 years. You shouldn't be buying old technology. You know, you should be buying a new model of satellite every few years anyway. Yet that's not how we've operated. I would love to see them take this approach and try it on the space side as well.
Amen. And he did. And for his part, Dr. Roper did say that we want to take this exact same approach and added GBSD also as one of the systems that is being so electronically designed. Let me just quickly go to John and Steve. I mean, do you guys also see the F-15 as a bit of a litmus test on this? Because on the one hand, you can understand that the Air Force wants what is a very, very capable long-range bomb truck. I know that we have an Eagle driver on our team here, although much more on the C side of things as a bloodthirsty fighter pilot. But do you guys see that as sort of a litmus test? I mean, what do you guys see as the litmus tests as guys who've covered all three of us have covered the Air Force now for the better part of, you know, three decades?
Yes, I think it may be. Clearly, when the F-15EX appeared, the then Secretary Heather Wilson and Chief of Staff Dade Goldfein bent over backwards to say this is not going to interfere with procuring fifth generation and moving forward. It is something that came to the Air Force from the CAPE office. Jim Mattis, who is no longer the Secretary of Defense. And the idea was to give some relief to the F-15C fleet, which is flight restricted and very old and overstressed and structurally fatigued. What do they do for those F-15s? I don't know. I suppose you could potentially build more F-35s, or if Roper is right and this thing is this new NGAD is close to being produced, maybe it'll be that. They've been very, very careful about giving any kind of answers when we ask about, well, look, what's the timetable for these things? What are the off ramps? When will we know if we're going to build 144 EXs or whether we're going to stop at 50 or 70 or 80 or go all the way to 200? Nobody's been able to provide any answers about that.
Steve?
I'll defer to, you know, people like General Daptula and Todd Harrison about the operational side of it. But I mean, certain programs just present themselves as easy targets, and certainly a program that hasn't really gotten into a full production rate, you know, that it, you know, is extraneous by definition. I mean, maybe that's a little bit harsh to say, but it's, you know, they have another fighter that can do the job. That is in full rate production. That's a lot harder target to go after. So whenever a service starts saying, "Where are we going to get money to do things?" That's where you look. Those are the easy targets.
Let me ask one last question, because one of the things which, you know, characterizes the Air Force, because the Air Force is born of the Army, you know, Adam's rib, born of the Army's rib. It tends to be a service that there is the book. You do things by the book. If it's in the book, you do it. Whereas the Navy sort of has no book, which is both its gift and its curse, in some ways. And what General Brown is talking about is actually completely upending that, to the point where airmen heard their chief say, "Give your supervisor 2 days' warning. If they do not tell you no, go ahead and do it." That is a very powerful, empowering message, and the sort of thing that is actually brilliant, because now you're getting airmen to sort of buy into it. As long as this happens in a disciplined way and doesn't actually become a disruptive influence. Let's get your sense on this, because Dave, you know, you're the airman who wore the uniform for 35 plus years, almost 40 years if you you know, include your time in ROTC, right? So talk to me about how that message goes over as an empowering thing, and then anybody else who wants to play into that, because I know we've got a former Air Force captain in the form of Todd Harrison as well, and then John also. So, Dave, take it away.
Yeah, no, I think it comes across extraordinarily well in the context of it will be very well received, because one of the concerns and issues, quite frankly, over the last decade is the fact that airmen haven't been listened to. And what I'm talking about is inside the Air Force. And then senior airmen haven't been kind of pressing forward with new and innovative ideas, or haven't been allowed to, because when they did, they were shot between the eyes by a Secretary of Defense who was so focused on the present, he couldn't see the future. But I digress. The fact of the matter is that the kind of language that you're hearing out of General Brown is one that takes the Air Force back to the attitude that existed by its founding pioneers, that of innovation, that of not being afraid to advocate or articulate for new ideas, you know, and all within the construct of constructive leading edge thought to deal with the multiple challenges that we have ahead. So I think it's a refreshing message. I think it's one that's long overdue, and I think it's one that will be accepted by the force and will stimulate them and motivate them to offer new and innovative ideas that we so sorely need.
Yeah, Vago, I would say, first of all, that quote struck me as well. In fact, I typed it up right away, and in Air Force Magazine, we have a section called verbatim, and I put it in verbatim for the next month because I thought it was a very telling comment. It's clearly aimed at this new deployment model where the Air Force is going to be playing the shell game, island hopping, moving around from one austere base to another so that it gives adversaries less to shoot at, less time to find them and shoot at them. So, I think it kind of encapsulates the future strategic concept for how the Air Force is going to deploy in wartime.
And Todd, let me bring you into this as well. And Steve, if you want to play into this as well, you're also welcome. Go ahead, Todd.
Yeah. I didn't know we could count our ROTC years. So I'm up to 9 years now in service. No, but I would say that, you know, I like a lot of what I'm hearing the new chief, General Brown, talk about. You know, I think he is hitting on all the right areas. You know, in his strategic approach document, you know, he talked about, you know, rethinking roles and missions and how they're allocated across the services. And I think rethinking how, you know, you treat people and how those ideas are allowed to bubble their way up. But also, I want to, what I'm looking for is I want to see some concrete action. And it is too soon. He hasn't been in the job that long. But, you know, let's see them start doing things like changing the way they do job assignments in the Air Force. Do a better job of matching people to positions that they really want and are really, you know, educated and skilled for. So, you know, there are a lot of things they could do. They've got a lot of additional authorities in how they manage the personnel system that they got from the NDAA 2 or 3 years ago. They haven't used them yet. It's time they start using them. And I think when you make those fundamental systemic changes, it will lead to a force where you've got people that are more innovative, more creative, more risk-taking, that are going to charge ahead faster, which is what they want.
Steve, any last thoughts before we part?
Well, just on the roles and missions, I think it's a really interesting time. Like you, Vago, you're probably gearing up for AUSA, and that's my next big event. Right. And we're going to hear a very different message there. You know, I remember back in June, retired General Formica published a white paper on AUSA's website about all the things that the Army needs to keep from, you know, the Space Force getting their hands on. And you know, on the long-range precision fire side, you'll have General Rafferty. You know, where last year he said explicitly, we can't rely on the Air Force anymore to do that mission. And so that's where the fight's going to be. And, you know, we might find out the result of that in this budget cycle. It might take another couple of years to resolve, but it's the real issue right now.
One thing I would add there, General Brown was talking about the new roles and missions discussion more than a year ago when he was at PACAF. General Goldfein, the last chief of staff, didn't have a stomach for it. And recently I talked to General Hyten, the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs. He's not interested in it, but it seems like Brown is pressing forward and he wants to get this stuff figured out. So more power to him if he can make a difference there.
Look, at the end of the day, you know, I don't want this to come across as a pro Air Force statement. At the end of the day, you don't need to relitigate 1947 all over again. At 15-year intervals, the Army wants to recreate its own Air Force, and it manifests itself whether through the Aerial Common Sensor program or buying 150 C-27s or building Gray Eagles that have a strike capability, a CAS capability within the confines of the Army, as opposed to looking at it and saying, what are each of the unique capabilities the services bring, have maybe some overlap, but at the end of the day, not reinvent the wheel. There are a lot of things that long-range precision fires bring you, but maybe you should not be trying to replicate a United States Air Force at the end of the day and somehow make the case the Air Force can't fly and operate in these areas, because so far the United States Air Force has demonstrated that it can fly into defended areas and still be able to project force there. So I agree, Steve, and thanks very much for bringing that up. I think it's an important thing, and it's important to have this debate in a structured way as opposed to an air chief posing it. And by the way, I mean, I think a bigger issue with JADC2 is the United States Air Force is all in and committed to it and ABMS, whereas the other services, as we heard at the West Coast Aerospace Forum, right, Todd and mm-hmm. and Dave, you know, an extraordinary event that you guys work every year to put on. You know, what was the message we heard from the Navy? We're going to cooperate with this as far as our own equities allow, which means we're going to do our own stuff. And if it manages to connect, we'll do it, as opposed to actually saying, unless we're 100% committed to cross-connecting, this isn't going to work. So I think a lot of work there and a lot of discussions.
Yeah, Vago, let me just emphasize one thing that you said that I think is extraordinarily important, and that is making some critical investment decisions just based on assertion. So you have some folks out there that are saying, well, we might not be able to count on what the Air Force. Well, okay, where's the proof? Where is the demonstrable evidence saying that this magnificent Air Force with the capabilities that have basically brought the entire Department of Defense a series of capacities and capabilities that are indispensable to the entirety of joint force operations. Where's your proof? So it's good to have folks realize that, you know, perhaps before we open up the shed to and the doors to, oh, invest in whatever you want, let 1,000 flowers bloom, we ought to induce some discipline into the future investment process, because if we don't, the budget will do it automatically.
And if I can jump in here, Vago, know that we don't have to completely relitigate the Key West agreement, but we are going to have to tweak it. And number one, you're going to have to, because we have a new service now, right? And, right. You know, as Dave alluded to before, General Raymond's one of his big tasks over the next year or so is going and scraping in all of those space components, their budgets, and their personnel from the other services. And they're not going to give them up easily.
And the NRO.
I agree with you.
Yep. This thing is going to become a shambles.
I agree. You need the NRO. That's not next year, though.
No, but you're absolutely right. But each of the services is finding a reason not to put their people in part making the argument that these, we need tissue. Guys,
I think General Raymond has drawn a clear line that if we have the other services building, launching, and operating satellites, then something has gone wrong, that this is not working. And so we've got to tweak the Key West agreement. And while you're at it, it's not just space that needs to be reallocated. There are other missions. We're talking about like long range strike. Like, why is the Army trying to build this? You know, why is the Navy operating all these fixed wing manned aircraft that are, you know, not based on carriers or land based? There's a lot of it that we need to go back and look at, that things we just haven't looked at in a long time, or new missions that have evolved over time. And it's time to rethink some of that.
Thanks very much, guys. Really, really appreciate it. Fantastic conversation. Would love to get this group back together again to talk about some of those very same issues, because I think each one of you has touched on important stuff that I'd like to delve deeper into. So maybe we can have you all come back in a couple of weeks' time. And I commend everybody who's listening to tune in and listen to some of those on-demand conversations. A lot of great comments from the major command commanders. General Van Ovost from Air Mobility Command was really compelling. Jeff Harigian, Cobra Harigian from USAFE, General Wilsbach out in PACAF, Tim Ray. Check out our interview with General Ray, which was a great conversation, including about nuclear deterrence and all the way on through. A lot of fascinating and worthwhile conversations. Guys, thanks very much again. Really appreciate it and look forward to having you back on.
Thanks, Vago.
Thank you. Thanks.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir, and thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn, and stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.